Chapter 11. Stephen sat by his patient in the gently rocking sick bay. He had almost certainly pulled him through the crisis. The faint, thready pulse had strengthened this last hour. Temperature had dropped, breathing was almost normal. But this triumph occupied only a remote corner of his mind. The rest was filled with dread. As a listener, a half-unconscious listener, he had heard too much good of himself. The doctor's all right. The doctor will not see us abused. The doctor's for liberty. He has instruction, he has the French. He's an Irish person, too. The murmur of conversation at the far end had dropped to an expectant silence. The men were looking eagerly towards him, nudging one another, and a tall Irishman, visiting a sick shipmate, stood up, his face turned towards the doctor. At his first movement, Stephen slipped out of the sick bay. On the quarterdeck he saw Parker talking with the marine lieutenant, both gazing at a line of battleship, a three-decker standing southwest with all her canvas abroad, stunsails port and starboard, tearing down the channel with a white bow wave streaming along her side. Two midshipmen off duty sat making a complex object out of rope in the gangway.
"Mr. Parslow," said Stephen, "pray be so good as to ask the captain if he is at leisure."
"I'll go when I finish this," said Parslow coolly, without getting up.
Babington dropped his feed, kicked Parslow vehemently down the ladder, and said, "I'll go, sir." A moment later he came running back. "Captain has chips with him just now, sir, but we'll be very happy in 5 minutes."
Very happy was a conventional phrase, and it was obvious that Captain Aubrey had had an unpleasant conversation with his carpenter. There was a lump of rotten wood with a drawn bolt in it on his desk, and a shattered, bludgeoned look on his face. He stood up, awkward, doubtful, embarrassed, his head bent under the beam.
"I am sorry to have to ask for this interview, sir," said Stephen, "but it is probable there will be a mutiny tomorrow night, when the ship is in with the French coast. The intention is to carry her into Saint-Valery."
Jack nodded.
This confirmed his reading of the situation. The Sophie's downcast, wretched looks, the men's demeanour, the 24-pound shot that had left their racks to trundle about the deck in the middle watch. His ship was falling to pieces under his feet. His crew were falling away from their duty and their allegiance. "Can you tell me who are the ringleaders?"
"I cannot."
"No, sir, you may call me many things, but not an informer. I have said enough, more than enough."
"No." Many surgeons with a foot in each world were more than half in sympathy with mutineers. There had been that man at the Nore, and the unfortunate Davidson they hanged for it at Bombay, and even Killick, his own servant, even Bondon. And they must have known something of what was brewing, wouldn't inform on their shipmates, although they were very close to him. "Thank you for having come to see me," he said stiffly. When the door had closed behind Stephen, he sat down with his head in his hands and let himself go to total unhappiness, to something near despair. So many things together, and now this cold, evil look. He reproached himself most bitterly for not having seized this chance for an apology. "If only I could have got it out." But he spoke so quick, and he was so very cold. Though indeed I should have looked the same if any man had given me the lie. It's not to be borne. What in God's name possessed me? So trivial, so beside the point, as gross as a schoolboy calling names, unmanly.
However, he shall make a hole in me whenever he chooses. And then again, what should I have the air of? Suddenly growing abject now that I know he's such a deadly old file. Yet throughout this period of indulgence, some other part of his brain was dealing with the immediate problem, and almost without a transition he said, "By God, I wish I had MacDonald." This had nothing to do with a desire for comfort or counsel. He knew that MacDonald disapproved of him, but for efficiency. MacDonald was an officer-like man. This puppy Smithers was not. Still, he might not be wholly inept. He rang his bell and said, "Pass the word for Mr. Smithers." "Sit down, Mr. Smithers. Tell me over the names of your marines, if you please." "Very good. And there is your sergeant, of course. Now, listen to what I say. Think of each of these men separately with great attention, and tell me whether or no each is to be relied upon."
"Why, of course they are, sir,"
cried Smithers. "No, no. Think, man, think," said Jack, trying to force some responsibility from that pink smirk. "Think. And reply when you really thought. This is of the very first consequence." His look was exceedingly penetrating and savage. It had effect. Smithers lost countenance and began to swear. He did evidently put his mind into painful motion. His lips could be seen moving, telling over the muster. Then after some time he came up with the answer, "Perfectly reliable, sir, except for a man called, well, he has the same name as me, but no sort of connection, of course, a papist from Ireland." "You will answer for that? You are dead certain of what you say?" "I said dead certain." "Yes, sir," said Smithers, staring, terribly upset. "Thank you, Mr. Smithers. You are to mention this conversation to no one. That is a direct, absolute order. And you are to display no uneasiness. Pray desire Mr. Goodridge to come here at once." "Mr. Goodridge," he said, standing at his chart table, "be so good as to give me our position." "Exact, sir, or within a league or two?" asked the master, with his head on one side and his left eye closed. "Exact." "I must bring the logboard, sir." Jack nodded. The master returned, took up scale and compasses, and pricked the chart. "There, sir. I see. We're under courses and topsails?" "Yes, sir. We agreed to run down easy for Sunday's tide, if you remember, so as not to hang about in the offing, we being so recognisable." I believe, said Jack, studying the chart on the board, "I believe that we may catch this evening's tide. What do you say, master?"
"If the wind holds, sir, so we may, by cracking on regardless. I shouldn't care to answer for the wind, though. The glass is rising."
"Not mine," said Jack, looking at his barometer. "I should like to see Mr. Parker, if you please, and in the meantime it would be as well to get the stunsails, royals and skylines into the tops." "Mr. Parker, we have a mutiny on our hands. I intend to take the Polycrest into action at the earliest possible moment by way of dealing with the situation. We shall crowd sail to reach Chaulieu tonight. But before making sail, I shall speak to the men. Let the gunner load the two aftermost guns with grape. The officers are to assemble on the quarterdeck at 6 bells, in 10 minutes, with their sidearms. The marines will fall in with their muskets on the forecastle. No hurry or concern will be shown before that time. When all hands are called, the guns will be traversed forward, with an oldster standing by each one. When I've spoken to the hands and we make sail, no man is to be struck or started until further orders. May I offer an observation, sir?" "Thank you, Mr. Parker, no.
Those are my orders.
Very good, sir.
He had no confidence in Parker's judgment. If he'd asked the advice of any man aboard, it would have been Goodridge. But this was his responsibility as captain of the ship, and his alone. In any case, he felt that he knew more about mutinous hands than anyone on the quarter-deck of the Polycrest. As a disrated midshipman, he'd served before the mast in a discontented ship on the Cape Station. He knew it from the other side. He had a great affection for the foremast jack, and if he didn't know for certain what would go with the lower deck, at least he was quite sure what would not. He looked at his watch, put on his best coat, and walked on to the quarterdeck. Six bells in the forenoon watch. His officers were gathering round him, silent, very grave. "All hands aft, if you please, Mr. Parker," he said. The shrill pipes, the roaring down hatchways, the stampede, the redcoats trooping forward through the throng, silence but for the tapping of the reef points overhead. "Men," said Jack, "I know damn well what's going on. I know damn well what's going on, and I won't have it. What simple fellows you are to listen to a parcel of makey clever sea lawyers and politicians, glib, quick-talking coves. Some of you've put your necks into the noose. I say your necks into the noose. You see the Ville de Paris over there?" Every head turned to the line of battleship on the horizon. "I've only to signal her, or half a dozen other cruisers, and run you up to the yardarm with the Rogue's March playing. Damn fools to listen to such talk. But I'm not going to signal to the Ville de Paris, nor to any other king's ship. Why not? Because the Polycrest is going into action this very night, that's why, and I'm not going to have it said in the fleet that any Polycrest is afraid of hard knocks." "That's right," said a voice. Joe Place, well out in front, his mouth wide open. "It's not you, sir," said another unseen. "It's him, old Parker, the hard horse bugger." "I'm going to take the Polycrest in tonight," Jack went on in a growing roar of conviction, "and I'm going to hammer the Frenchmen in Chaulieu in their own port, do you hear me? If there's any man here afraid of hard knocks, he'd better stay behind. Is there any man here afraid of hard knocks?" A kind of universal growl. Not ill-natured. Some laughter. Further cries of that hard horse bugger. "Silence fore and aft. Well, I'm glad there ain't. There are some awkward hands among us still. Look at that wicked, ugly slab line. And some men that talk too much. But I never thought there was a faint heart aboard. They may say the Polycrest ain't very quick in stays. They may say she don't furl her topsails all that pretty. But if they say she's shy, if they say she don't like hard knocks, why, black the white of my eye. When we thumped it into the Boulogne, there wasn't a single foremast jack that didn't do his duty like a lion. So we'll run into Chaulieu, I say, and we'll hammer Bonaparte. That's the right way to bring the war to an end. That's the right way, not listening to a set of galley rangers and clever chaps. And the sooner it's over and you can go home, the better I'll be pleased. I know it's not a bed of roses looking after our country the way we have to. Now, I'll tell you this and mark what I do say. There's going to be no punishment over this business. It will not even be logged, and there's my word upon it. There's going to be no punishment. But every man and boy must attend to his duty tonight. He must mind it very carefully, because Chaulieu's a tough nut to crack. An awkward set of shoals, an awkward tide, and we must be every hand to his rope and haul with a will, do you hear? Quick's the word and sharp's the action. Now, I'm going to pick some men for the barge, and then we shall crowd all the sail she can bear." He walked into the tight crowd of men, into the low buzz of talk. The whispers and silence went before him. Smiling, confident faces, worried faces or blank, some apprehensive, some brute, terrified and savage. "Davis," he said, "go along into the barge. The man's eyes were frightened as a wild beast's. He darted looks left and right. "Come on now, come along. You heard what I said," said Jack quietly, and Davis lumbered aft, bowed and unnatural. The silence was general now, the atmosphere quite different. But he wasn't going to leave these men to have dinner with their messmates and try some desperate foolery. He was in a state of exceedingly acute awareness. He had no shadow of a doubt of the men he chose. Wilcox, into the barge. Anderson. He was far in among them. He had no weapons. Johnson, look alive. The tension was heightening very fast. It must go no higher. Bondon, into the barge. He said, looking over his coxswain's head.
"Me, sir?"
cried Bondon piteously. "Cut along," said Jack. Bantock, Lakey, Screech. The low, excited talk had begun again on the periphery. Men who could not be suspected were being sent into the barge. They were going aft down the stern ladder and into the boat towing behind. This was no punishment, nor no threat of punishment. He flemished down the offending slab line in a seamanlike manner and walked back to the quarterdeck. "Now, Polycrests," he said, "now we're going to crack on until she groans again. Stunsails aloft and alow, royals, and damn me royal stunsails and skysails, if she'll bear 'em. The sooner we're there, the sooner we're home. Top men, upper yard men, are you ready?"
"Ready, aye, ready, sir."
A comfortable, good body of sound. Relief, thankfulness. "Then at the word up you go. Lay aloft." The Polycrest bloomed like a white rose. Her rarely used stunsails stretched out brilliant white one after another. Her brand new royals shone high, and above them all her hitherto unseen skysails twinkled in the sun. The ship groaned and groaned again as they were sheeted home. She plunged her forefoot deep while behind her the barge raced along in her wake, the water almost to its gunwales. If the Polycrest could be said to have a good point of sailing, it was with the wind 3 points abaft the beam, and here the wind stayed all day, scarcely varying from west nor west by north, and blowing with a gentle urgency that kept all eyes aloft for the safety of her royals and skysails. She was cracking on indeed, racing down the channel as though their lives depended upon it, making so much water that Mr. Gray the carpenter, coming up from the well, officially registered his protest. She did carry away a skysail, and at one point a large, unidentified object tore from her bottom. But the leagues raced away in her wake, and Jack, perpetually on the quarterdeck, could almost have loved her. On the forecastle, the watch below were at their make and mend. The watch on duty were kept busy, necessarily busy, trimming sail, and everybody seemed to be enjoying the speed, the racing tension to get the last ounce out of her. His orders about starting were being punctually obeyed, and so far no man or boy seemed to move any slower for it. The men in the barge had been brought aboard, lest it should tow under, and they had had their dinner in the galley. He wasn't afraid of them now. Their influence was gone. Their shipmates avoided them. Davis, the really dangerous brute for a sudden reckless explosion, seemed wholly amazed. And Wilcox, the eloquent attorney's clerk turned pickpocket, could find no one to listen to him. The seamen, for the most part, had turned, with their usual calm volatility, from one disaster to the interval before the next. For the moment, he had the situation in hand. His only anxiety was the wind. As the afternoon wore on, it grew fainter and more irregular, giving every sign of falling away altogether with the setting of the sun. As the damp evening settled from the sky, with the dew tightening the rigging, it revived a little, still breathing from the longed-for northwest. But there was no trusting to it. By 6 o'clock, they had run off their distance, standing in to raise the unmistakable tower and headland of Point Noir,
with a cross-bearing on Camaret. But now, as they steered east-southeast to make the coast a little north of Chaulieu, the haze thickened. Thickened. Until, at the very entrance to Chaulieu Bay itself, they found themselves in a fog, their royals, faint blurs, high over the deck. A fog that lay a little above the smoothly swelling surface of the sea, and that was torn in long wafts of thick and clear, faintly luminous from the rising moon. They were no more than a little late for their tide, and they stood in steadily with the master at the con and two leads going without a pause. By the deep eight, by the deep eight, by the mark ten, a quarter less ten, by the deep nine, and a half seven, by the mark five, a quarter less five, and a half four. The bottom was shelving fast. "We're on the edge of the outer bank, sir," said the master, looking at the sample of shelly ooze from the lead. "All well. Topsail's alone, I believe." "She's yours, Mr. Goodridge," said Jack, and he stood back a step while the ship whispered through the water, and the master took her in. She'd been cleared for action long before. The hands were silent and attentive. The ship answered her helm promptly as she worked through the channel, sheets and braces tightening at the word. "That'll be the Galloper," said the master, nodding towards a stretch of pale water on the starboard bow. "Starboard a point. 2 points. Steady. Easy now. As she goes. Port your helm, hard over." Silence. Dead silence in the fog. "Morgan's knocked to larboard, sir," he said, coming aft. Jack was glad to hear it. Their last sure cross-bearing seemed a terribly long time ago, and this was Blind Man's Buff. It was water he didn't know. With Morgan's knock astern, they would have to bear westward round the tail of Old Paul Hill's bank, and then head a little south of east and so into the outer road crossing the Ile Saint-Jacques. "Starboard 3 points," said the master, and the ship swung to the west. It was wonderful how these old channel pilots knew their sea. By the smell and feel of it, no doubt. "Mind your bowline forward there," called the master in a low voice. A long, long pause, with the Polycrest close hauled to the now freshening breeze. "Down with your helm now, steady, steady, as she goes. Looks along the larboard bow. That's Saint-Jacques." A tear in the fog, and there, about a mile away, rose a tall, white mass, with a fortification on its top and halfway down its side. "Well done, Mr. Goodridge. Well done indeed." "On deck there," hailed the lookout. "Sail on the larboard beam." "Oh, a mort of craft," he added conversationally. "Eight, nine, a proper old crowd of 'em." "They'll be at the far end of the outer road, sir," said the master. "We're in it now." The breeze was tearing great windows in the fog, and gazing over to port, Jack had a sudden vision of an assembly of fair-sized vessels, ship and brig-rigged, bright in the moonlight. These were his prey, the transports and the cannoniere for the invasion. "You're happy that they're in the outer road, Mr. Goodridge?" he asked. "Oh, yes, sir. We just had Saint-Jacques bearing south-southeast. There's nothing but open water between you and them." "Down with your helm," said Jack. With the wind on her larboard quarter, the Polycrest ran through the sea, going fast in with the tide, straight for the gun vessels. "Out, Tompions," he said. "Stand to your guns." He meant to run right in among them, firing both sides to get the very most out of the surprise and the first discharge.
For a moment after it, all hell would break loose from the batteries, and the men would never be so steady again. The mist had drifted across again, but it was clearing. He could see them dimly coming closer and closer. "Not a gun till," he called, and a shock threw him flat on the deck. The Polycrest was brought up all standing. She had run full tilt on to the West Anvil. This was plain as he got to his feet, and the clearing of the fog showed one fort right astern and another almost exactly alike on the starboard bow, forts that woke to instant life with a shattering roar, a blast of flame that lit the night. They had mistaken Convention for Saint-Jacques, the inner road for the outer. They had come in by a different channel, and the vessels were separated from him by an impassable spit of sand. Those ships were in the inner, not the outer road. By some miracle, the Polycrest had all her masts still standing. She lifted on the swell and ground a little farther onto the bank. "Up, sheets!" he shouted full voice. No call for silence now. "Up, sheets!" The strain on the masts eased. "Parker, Pullings, Babington, Russell, get the guns aft!" If she were only hanging by her forefoot, this might bring her off. On the far side of the bank, a great flurry of canvas, ships getting underway in every direction. And amidst this confusion, two distinct, well-ordered shapes steering to cross his bows. Gun brigs, which marked their presence by two double jets of fire, meaning to rake him from stem to stern. "Leave the forecastle guns," he cried. "Mr. Russell, Adams, keep up a steady fire on those brigs." Now the moon shone out with surprising brilliance, and as the wind blew away the smoke, it showed the batteries as clear as day. It showed the whole inner road crowded with shipping, a corvette moored right up against Convention under its guns. Certainly the ship Thetis and Andromeda had chased in his quarry. A damn fool place to moor her, one thought among countless others racing through his head. It showed the deck of the Polycrest, most of the men well-disciplined, over their amazement, working fast at the guns, trundling them aft, not much concerned by the thunder of the forts. Saint-Jacques was firing wide, afraid of hitting its own people ahead of the Polycrest. Convention had not yet got the range. The iron hail was still high overhead. The gun brigs were more dangerous. He clapped onto a rope, helped run a gun aft, called for coins to wedge them until they could make fast. "All the people aft. All hands aft. We'll jounce her off. All jump together at the word. One, two. One, two." They jumped, 100 men together. Would their weight and the weight of the guns slide her off into deep water? One, two. One, two. It wouldn't. "Vast jumping." He ran forward, looking hard and quick right round the port, glanced at his watch, 9:15, not much left of the flood. "Get all the boats over the side. Mr. Parker," he said, "carronade into the barge." She had to be got off. A bower anchor carried out, dropped in deep water and heaved upon, would bring her off. But even the barge couldn't bear the weight of such an anchor. A larger vessel must be cut out. A ball passed within a few feet of him, and its wind made him stagger. A cheer from forward as the starboard carronade hit one of the gun brigs square on the figurehead. Something had to be cut out. The transports were all crowding sail for the Roi du Point. They couldn't be caught in time. There were some small luggers in the harbour mouth, the corvette alone under Convention's guns. Absurdly close under Convention's guns, moored fore and aft, 50 yards from the shore, broadside and headed towards Saint-Jacques. Why not the corvette herself? He dismissed the question as absurd. But why not? The risk would be enormous, but no greater than lying here under the crossfire once the batteries had the range. It was very near to wild, mad recklessness, but it was not quite there. And with the corvette in his possession, there would be no need to carry out an anchor. A time-consuming job. "Mr. Russell," he said, "take the barge. Draw off the fire of those brigs. Plenty of cartridge, 12 muskets. Make all the noise you can. Shout! Sing out!" The barge crew dropped over the side. Drawing a deep breath, he shouted above the guns, "Volunteers! volunteers to come along with me and cut out that corvette. Richards, serve out cutlasses, pistols, axes. Mr. Parker, you will stay in the ship.
The men wouldn't follow Parker. How many would follow him?
Mr. Smithers, the red cutter. You and your marines board over her starboard bow. Mr. Pulling's blue cutter to her larboard quarter, and the moment you're aboard, cut her cables. Take axes, then lay aloft and let fall her topsails. Attend to nothing else at all. Pick your men, quick. The rest come along with me and look alive now. There's not a moment to be lost.
Killick handed him his pistols, and he dropped into his gig, never looking behind him. The Polycrests poured over the side, thump, 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 down into the boats. The clash of arms, a voice bawling in his ear. Squeeze up, George, make room, can't you? How many men in the boats? 70? 80? Even more. A magnificent rise in his heart, all the blackness falling clear away.
Give way, he said. Silence all boats.
Bondon, right over the bank. Go straight for her. A crash behind him as a salvo from Convention took away the Polycrest's foretopmast. No great loss, he said, settling in the stern sheets with his sword between his knees. They touched once, a bare scrape on the top of the sandbank. Then they were beyond it, in the inner road, going straight for the corvette half a mile away. The risk was enormous. She might have 200 men aboard. But here again there was the chance of surprise. They would scarcely expect to be boarded from a grounded ship, not right under their own guns. Too far under their own guns. What a simple place to moor, for the Convention battery was high perched up on the headland. Its guns could never be depressed so far as to sweep the sea 200 or 300 yards in front of the fort. Only 500 yards to go. The men were pulling like maniacs, grunt, grunt, grunt. But the boat was crammed, heavy and encumbered, no room to stretch to their oars. Bondon wedged next to him. Little Parslow. That child should never have come. The purser, deathly pale in the moonlight, the villainous face of Davis, Lakey, Place, all the Sophies. 400 yards. And at last the corvette had woken to her danger. A hail, an uneven broadside, musketry. And now musketry crackling all along the shore. A deluge of water from Convention's great guns, no longer firing at the Polycrest, but at her boats, and missing only by a very little. And all the time the barge, banging away behind them at the gunbrigs with its little 6-pounder carronade, roaring, firing muskets, wonderfully diverting attention from this silent rush across the inner road. Convention again, at extreme depression, but firing over them. 200 yards. 1. The other boats drawing ahead, Smithers to the right, Pullings turning left-handed to go round her stern.
"Mizzen chains, Bondon," he said, loosening his sword in its scabbard. A shattering burst of fire, a great roaring. The marines were boarding her over the bows.
"Mizzen chains it is, sir," said Bondon, heaving on the tiller. A last broadside overhead, and the boat came kissing against the side. "Up!" He leapt on the high roll, his hands catching the deadeyes. "Up! No boarding netting, by God!" Men thrusting, grasping all round him, one holding his hair, up and over the rail, through the thin fringe of defenders, a few pikes, swabs, a musket banging in his ear, on to the quarter-deck, his sharp sword out, pistol in his left hand, straight for the group of officers shouting, "Polycrest! Polycrest!" A swarm of men behind him, a swirling scuffle by the mizzenmast, an open maul, men grappling silently, open, extreme, brutal violence. Fired his pistol, flinging it straight at the next man's face. Babington on his left, running full into the flash and smoke of a musket. He was down. Jack checked his rush and stood over him. Lunging hard, he deflected the plunging bayonet into the deck. His heavy sword carried on, and now, with all his weight and strength, he whipped it up in a wicked, backhanded stroke
that took the soldier's head half off his body. A little officer in the clear space in front of him, sword point darting at his breast. Swerve and parry, and there they were dancing towards the taffrail, their swords flashing in the moonlight. A burning stab in his shoulder, and before the officer could recover, his point Jack had closed, crashing the pommel into his chest and kicking his legs from under him. "Rendezvous," he said. "Je me rendre," said the officer on the deck, dropping his sword. "Parola!" Firing, crashing, shouting in the bows, in the waist, and now Pullings was over the side, hacking at the cables. Redcoats, dark in the moonlight, clearing the starboard gangway, and everywhere, everywhere, the shout of Pollycrest! Jack raced forward at the tight group by the mainmast, mostly officers. They were backing, firing their pistols, pointing swords and pikes. And behind them, on the landward side, their men were dropping into the boats and into the water by the score. Haynes ran past him, dodging through the fight, and hurled himself aloft, followed by a string of other men. Here was Smithers, shouting, sweating, a dozen other marines. They'd reached the quarterdeck from the bows. Now Pullings, with a bloody axe in his hand, and the topsails were letting fall, mizzen main and fore, men already at the sheets. "Capitaine!" cried Jack. "Capitaine! Cesse effusion sang! Rendezvous! Homme déserté! Rendezvous!"
"Jamais, monsieur," said the Frenchman, and came for him with a furious lunge.
"Bond and trip up his heels," said Jack, parrying the thrust and cutting high. The French captain's sword flashed up, Bondon ran beneath it, collared him, and it was over. Goodridge was at the wheel. Where had he come from? Calling like thunder for the foretopsail to be sheeted home. Already the land was gently receding, gliding, sliding, backwards and away. "Capitaine, en bas, dessous, s'il vous plaît. Tout officier dessous." Officers giving up their swords, Jack taking them, passing them to Bondon. Incomprehensible words. Italian? "Mr. Smithers, put him in the cable tier." An isolated scuffle and a single shot on the forecastle to join the firing from the shore. Bodies on deck, the wounded crawling. She was heading westward, and the blessed wind was just before her beam. She must go round the tail of the West Anvil before she could tack to reach the Pollycrest, and all the way she would be sailing straight into the fire of Saint-Jacques. Half a mile's creep always closer to that deadly, raking battery. "Foresail and driver!" cried Jack. The quicker the better, and above all, she must not miss stays. She seemed to be handling beautifully, but if she missed stays, she'd be cut to pieces. Convention was firing behind them. Wildly at present, though one great ball passed through all three topsails, he hurried forward to help sort out the foresail tack. The deck was swarming with Pollycrests. They called out to him, tearing high spirits, some quite beside themselves. "Wilkins," he said, putting his hand on the man's shoulder, "you and Shattuck start getting the corpses over the side." She was a trim little vessel. 20 guns. Broader than the Pollycrest. Fanciulla was her name. She was indeed the Fanciulla. Why did Saint-Jacques not fire? "Mr. Mallock, clear away the small bower and get a cable out of a stern port." Why did they not fire? A triple crash abaft the mainmast, Convention hulling the corvette, but nothing from Saint-Jacques. Saint-Jacques had not yet realised that the Fanciulla had been carried. They thought she was standing out to attack the grounded Pollycrest. "Long may it last," he said. The tack was hard down, the corvette moving faster through the water. Slack water now. He looked at his watch, holding it up to the moon. And a flash from Saint-Jacques showed him just 11. They had smoked him at last. But the tail of the sandbank was no great way off. "I killed one, sir," cried Parslow, running across the deck to tell him. "I shot him into the body just as he was going for Mr. Barker with the half-pike." Very good, Mr. Parslow. Now, cut along to the cable tier and give Mr. Mallock a hand, will you? Mr. Goodridge, I believe we may go about very soon.
Another 100 yards, sir, said the master, his eyes fixed on Saint-Jacques. I must just get those two turrets in a line. Nearer, nearer. The towers were converging.
All hands, shouted Jack. Ready about ship. Mr. Pullings, are you ready there? The towers blazed out, vanished in their own smoke. The corvette's mizzen topmast went by the board. Sheets of spray flew over the quarterdeck. Ready-o! Helms alee! Up tacks and sheets! Haul mainsails! Haul!
Round she came, paying off all the faster for the loss of her after sails.
Haul of all! Haul with a will!
She was round, had spun like a cutter, and now, with the wind 3 points free, she was running for the Polycrest. The Polycrest with no foremast, no main t'gallant, and only the stump of her bowsprit, but still firing her forward carronades and cheering thinly as the Fanchula ran alongside, came up into the wind on the far side of the channel and dropped anchor.
All well, Mr. Parker? Hailed Jack. All's well, sir. We're a little knocked about and the barge sank alongside, but all's well. Rig the capstan, Mr. Parker, and make a lane for the cable.
The roar of guns, the din of shot hitting both ships, tearing up the water and passing overhead, drowned his voice. He repeated the order and went on, Mr. Pullings, veer the cutter under the stern to take the line.
Red cutter was stove by that old topmast, sir, and I'm afraid the marine's painter came adrift like somehow. Only your gig left, sir. The Frenchman went ashore in all then.
The gig, then. Mr. Goodridge, as soon as the cable is to, start heaving ahead. Pullings, come with me.
He dropped into the gig, took the line in his hand, their lifeline, and said, We shall need at least 20 more men for the capstan. Ply to and from as quick as ever you can, Pullings.
The Polycrest again, and hands reaching eagerly from the sternport for the line. A mortar shell burst, brilliant orange, closer to the gun brigs than to its target.
Hot work, sir, said Parker. I wish you joy of your prize.
He spoke with an odd hesitation, forcing the words. In the light of the flashes, he looked an old, old man, bent and old.
Thank you, Parker. Pretty warm. Clap onto the line there. Heave hearty.
The line came in hand over hand, followed briskly by a small hawser, and then far more slowly by a great, heavy snake of cable. Pulling's men kept coming aboard, and at last the cable was to the capstan. While the bars were being swifted, Jack looked at his watch again. Just past midnight. The tide had been ebbing for half an hour.
"Heave away!" he called to the Fanchula.
"Now, Polycrest, step out! Heave hearty! Heave and rally!" The capstan span, the pawls going click, 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 the cable began to rise from the sea to tauten, squirting water. And now, with the gun brig shearing off, frightened by the shell, Saint-Jacques let fly. Heavy mortars, all the guns they possessed. A shot killed 4 men at the bars. The main topmast toppled over the forecastle. The gig was knocked to pieces alongside just as its last man left it.
Heave! Heave and rally! Cried Jack, slipping in the blood and kicking a body out of his way as he forced the bar round. Heave! Heave!
The cable rose right from the sea, almost straight. The men saved from the gig flung themselves on the bars.
Heave! Heave! She moves!
Clear through the roar of guns they could hear, or rather feel, the grind of the ship's bottom shifting off the sand. A kind of gasping cheer. The pawls clicked once more, twice, and then they were flat on their faces, no resistance in the bars at all, the capstan turning free. A ball had cut the cable. Jack fell with the rest. He was trampled upon. Clearing himself from the limbs and bodies, he leapt to the rail.
Goodridge! Goodridge, ahoy! Can you bring her alongside?
I dare not, sir, not on the ebb. I've only got a couple of fathoms here. No boat?
No boat. Heave in quick and bend on another line. Do you hear me now?
He could scarcely hear himself. The gun brigs had worked round and were firing over the bank from near the harbour. He stripped off his coat,
laid down his sword and went straight in. And as he dived, a jagged piece of iron caught him on the head, sending him deep under. But dazed or not, his body swam on, and he found his hands, scrabbling at the Fanchula's side. "Haul me aboard," he cried. He sat, gasping and streaming, on deck. "Is there anyone here can swim?" Not a word, no answer. "I'll try on a grating," said an anxious voice. "Give me the line," he said, walking to the stern ladder. "Won't you sit down, sir, and take a dram? You're all bloody, sir," said Goodridge, with a beseeching look into his face. Jack shook his head impatiently, and the blood spattered the deck. Every second counted on the ebb. Even now there was 6 inches less of water round the Polycrest. He went down the ladder, let himself into the water, and pushed off, swimming on his back. The sky was in a state of almost continual coruscation. Between flashes the moon shone out, her face bent like a shield. Abruptly he realised that there were 2 moons, floating apart, turning, and Cassiopeia was the wrong way about. Water filled his throat. "By God, I'm tiring. Wits going," he said, and slid round in the water, straining his head up and taking his bearings. The Polycrest was far over on his left, not ahead, and hailing. Yes, they were hailing. He took a turn with the line round his shoulder and concentrated his whole spirit on swimming, fixing the ship, plunging with every stroke, fixing it again. But such feeble strokes. Of course. It was against the tide. And how the line dragged. Thus. "Very well, thus," he said, changing his direction to allow for the current. In the last 20 yards his strength seemed to revive, but he could only cling there under her stern, no force in his arms to get aboard. They were fussing about, trying to haul him in. "Take the line, God damn you all!" he cried in a voice that he heard from a distance. "Carry it forward and heave! Heave!" At the foot of the stern ladder, Bondon lifted him out of the water, guided him up, and he sat on a match-tub while the capstan turned fast, then slower, slower, slower. And all the time the heave, the slow, steady swell, lifted the Polycrest's stern and sat it down with a thump on the hard sand, and all the French artillery played upon her. The carpenter hurried past with still another wad to stop a shot-hole. They'd hulled the Polycrest perhaps 12 times since he'd been back aboard, but now he was utterly indifferent to their fire, a mere background, a nuisance, a hindrance to the one thing that really mattered. "Heave and rally! Heave and rally!" he cried. The full strain was on, not a click from the capstan poles. He staggered to an empty place on a bar and threw his weight forward, slipping in blood, finding his feet again. Click! And the whole capstan was groaning. Click! "She moves," whispered the man next to him. A slow, hesitant grind. And then, as the swell came along from aft, she lifted clear. "She swims! She swims!" Wild cheering, and an answering cheer from over the water. "Heave! Heave!" he said. "She must be pulled full clear." Now the capstan turned, now it fairly span, faster than the cable could be passed forward, and the Polycrest surged heavily right into the deep channel. "Vast heaving. All hands to make sail. Mr. Parker, everything that can be set." "What? I beg pardon, sir, I didn't..." It didn't matter. The seamen who had heard were aloft. The tattered mainsail dropped, the main staysail almost whole, and the Polycrest had steering way. She was alive under him, and the life rose into his heart, quite filling him again. "Mr. Goodridge!" he shouted out with new strength. "Cut your cables and lead me out by the Redoufoir. Veer out of Tolan as soon as you're underway."
"Aye, aye, sir."
He took the wheel, moving her over to the windward side of the channel so that her leeway shouldn't run her aground again. Lord, how heavy she was, and how she wallowed on the swell. How low in the water, too. A little more sail appeared. Mizzen topmast staysail, a piece of driver, odd scraps, but they gave her 2 knots.
and with the run of the tide setting straight down the channel, he should carry her out of range in 10 minutes. Mr. Rolfe? Mr. Rolfe's dead, sir. His mate, then. The guns, back into their places. It was no good asking Parker. The man was only just holding himself upright. Mr. Pullings, take some lively hands forward and see if you can pick up the tow line. What is it, Mr. Gray? 6 foot of water below, sir, if you please. And the doctor says, may you put the wounded into your cabin. He moved him from the cockpit to the gunroom, but now it's all awash. Yes, certainly. Can you come at any more of the holes? We'll have the pumps going directly. I'll do my best, sir, but I fear it's not the shot holes. She's opening like a flower. A fury of shot drowned his words, some of it glowing red, for now they had the furnaces at work. Mostly wide and astern, but 3 went home, jarring the waterlogged ship from stem to stern and cutting the last of her starboard mizzen shrouds. Babington came staggering aft, 1 sleeve hanging empty, to report the towline aboard and made fast to the knightheads. Very good, Mr. Babington. Alan, take some hands below and help Dr. Maturin move the wounded into the cabin. He realised that he was shouting with great force, and that there was no need to be shouting. Everywhere, apart from 1 wicked long gun in the Convention battery, there was silence. Silence and dimness. For the moon was dipping low. He felt the towline tighten, plucking at the polycrest, and she gave a little spurt. The corvette, just ahead, had set her courses as well as main and 4 topsails, and they were busy clearing the wreck of her mizzen topmast. What a pretty thing she was, taut and trim, great strength in her pull, she'd be a fast one. They were running along the landward edge of the east anvil. The bank was above the surface now, with a gentle surf breaking over it, and ahead of them was the opening of the Rat du Point, full of the transports. They too seemed unaware of the Fanchula's changed character. Sitting ducks, the chance of a lifetime. Mr. Goodridge there, how are your guns? Prime, sir, prime. Brass 12-pounders and 4/8. Plenty of cartridge filled. Then lead right through those transports, will you?
Aye, aye, sir.
Jenkins, how's our powder?
Drowned, sir. The magazine's drowned.
But we got 3 rounds, a gun and shot aplenty.
Then double shot him, Jenkins, and we'll give him a salute as we pass by.
It would be no stylish broadside. There were scarcely enough men even to fire both sides, let alone run the guns in and out loading fast. But it would mark the point. And it was in his orders. He laughed aloud. And he laughed, too, to find that he was holding himself up by the wheel. The moonlight faded. The Rat du Point glided very slowly nearer. Pullings had set up some kind of a jury-rig forward, and another sail was drawing. Parslow was fast asleep under the shattered fife-rail. Now there was movement, agitation among the transports. He heard a hail and a muffled response from the Fanchula, followed by low laughter. Sails appeared, and with them confusion. The Fanchula was 100 yards ahead. "Mr. Goodridge," called Jack, "back your main topsail a trifle." The polycrest ploughed heavily on, closing the distance. The transports were moving in several directions. At least 3 had fallen foul of one another in the narrow channel. The moments passed in dreamlike procession, and then suddenly there it was, the immediate vivid action, vivid even after all this saturation of noise and violence. 1 transport on the port bow, 200 yards away, 3 locked together aground to starboard. "Fire as they bear," said Jack, putting down the helm 2 points. At the same moment the Fanchula burst into flame and smoke, a much shriller crash. Now they were in the middle of them, firing both sides. The grounded vessels waved lanterns, shouting something that couldn't be heard. Another, having missed stays, drifted down the polycrest side after the last carronade had shot its final charge. Her yards caught in the polycrest's remaining shrouds, some bright spirit lashed her mainyard fast, and standing there right under the mouth of her empty guns, her commander said he had struck.
"Take possession, Mr. Pullings," said Jack. "Keep close under my lee. You can only have 5 men. Mr. Goodridge! Mr. Goodridge! Stand on!" In 30 minutes the channel was clear of floating transports. 3 had grounded, 2 had run themselves ashore, 1 had sunk the 24-pound smashers at close range, and the rest had doubled into the outer road or back to Chaulieu, where 1 was set ablaze by red-hot shot from Saint-Jacques. And in 30 minutes, the time to run the length of the channel and to wreak all this havoc, the Polycrest was moving so heavily, keeping such a strain on the tow line, that Jack hailed the Fanchula and the transport to come alongside. He went below, Bondon holding him by the arm, confirmed the carpenter's desperate report, gave orders for the wounded to be moved into the corvette, the prisoners to be secured, his papers brought, and sat there as the 3 vessels rocked on the gentle swell of slack water, watching the tired men carry their shipmates, their belongings, all the necessaries out of the Polycrest.
"It's time to go, sir," said Parker, with Pullings and Rossall standing by him, ready to lift their captain over.
"Go," said Jack. "I shall follow you."
They hesitated, caught the earnestness of his tone and look, crossed, and stood hovering on the rail of the corvette. Now the veering breeze blew off the land. The eastern sky was lightening. They were out of the Ras de Point, beyond the shoals, and the water in the offing was a fine, deep blue. He stood up, walked as straight as he could to a ruined gunport, made a feeble spring that just carried him to the Fanchula, staggered, and turned to look at his ship. She didn't sink for a good 10 minutes, and by then the blood, what little he had left, had made a pool at his feet. She went very gently, with a sigh of air rushing through the hatches, and settled on the bottom, the tips of her broken masts showing a foot above the surface.
"Come, brother," said Stephen in his ear, very like a dream. "Come below. You must come below. Here is too much blood altogether. Below, below. Here, Bondon, carry him with me."